Info at itascaorchestra.org.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Since Hurricane Helene hit, social media has been full of false rumors that the government is controlling the weather and more. We talked to a Republican congressman trying to clear up the misinformation.
I had my staff answering phones and responding when we could have been fielding the calls from folks that were still asking for help.
And a Michigan County clerk speaks on being an election worker in a battleground state. Plus, it's spooky season and we're talking folk horror. So break out your floral crowns and talismans. It's Sunday, October 13th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Cheers broke out for spaceflight company SpaceX a short time ago when mechanical arms caught the returning booster rocket on the same tower that launched the fifth test flight of the company's enormous Starship.
T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The successful capture of the rocket would allow the booster to be reused for future missions. Vice President Kamala Harris is in North Carolina today, where she is to speak at a church service and rally supporters in Greenville. Former President Donald Trump has been campaigning this weekend in western states, holding a campaign event in Las Vegas and speaking at an outdoor event in California's Coachella Valley, east of Los Angeles.
I stand before you today in the heart of the majestic Coachella Valley to declare that the Republican Party will always put America first and lead us on to victories like you have never seen before. We got a big victory.
Trump repeated familiar themes during his speech, including demonizing migrants. He is to rally supporters in Prescott Valley, Arizona today. Turnout among Asian Americans in Pennsylvania could be critical in this election year, as NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports.
There are more than a quarter million Asian Americans and Pacific Islander voters in Pennsylvania. But historically, there has been a lack of outreach to AAPI voters for years from both parties, says James De Los Reyes, who works with the Asian Pacific Islander Political Alliance, an advocate group for AAPI voters in Pennsylvania.
The thinking for a really long time is that the Asian community is too difficult and too expensive to really invest in and try to bring in politically.
In recent years, though, engagement with AAPI voters has increased. While these voters tend to vote blue, they don't identify strongly with the political party, which could make them persuadable in key swing states. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, Philadelphia.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is appealing to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to remove UN peacekeepers from areas in South Lebanon where Israeli forces are fighting Hezbollah. The UN blames Israeli forces for injuring five separate peacekeepers in separate incidents since last Thursday. Lebanese authorities say Israeli airstrikes overnight have hit several villages outside Hezbollah's heartland areas. The BBC's Sebastian Usher reports.
Hezbollah says that its fighters have been involved in combat at point-blank range with Israeli troops in a village near the border with Israel. The IDF says that in addition to two severely wounded soldiers, many others have been evacuated to hospital with light and moderate injuries. The fighting in South Lebanon is intensifying as Lebanese officials say that Israel has widened its target area across the country. The IDF says that it's carried out airstrikes on around 200 Hezbollah targets in the past 24 hours.
This is NPR News. Metro Nashville Police Commander Anthony McLean says several officers were on duty in the area where gunshots rang out as Tennessee State University celebrated homecoming this weekend.
It's unfortunate that a few folks pretty much ruined it for everybody. Okay, so we have to come to the point where we stop this violence.
At least one person was killed. Nine others were injured near TSU. Police say one of the injured is suspected to have been involved in the gunfire. Three victims are juveniles. Police say they believe two groups began shooting at each other from opposite sides of a street that had just reopened after the homecoming parade. The National Ballet of Ukraine is touring the U.S. for the first time since the country gained independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the dancers are trying to raise awareness and money to build bomb shelters at Ukrainian schools.
One of the pieces the National Ballet of Ukraine is performing is called Prayer for the Fallen. Behind the dancers, a giant screen shows 3D images of scenes from their war-ravaged country. Principal soloist Yaroslav Kachuk says he and the dancers see this tour as a responsibility to their compatriots fighting on the front lines.
And this inspires us to preserve our culture the same way as they're preserving us.
The National Ballet of Ukraine's tour of the East Coast includes stops in New York City, Atlanta, and Miami. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, supporting human rights advocates worldwide in the fight for democracy, equity, and justice for all people. Learn more at ajws.org.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning, and thank you for being here with us today. It's been about 2 weeks since Iran's strike on Israel, and Israel has vowed to strike back, which would signal a major escalation of tensions. The six Gulf Arab states that make up the Gulf Cooperation Council, or GCC, which includes Saudi Arabia, are anxiously watching for that Israeli response. Mehran Hagirian is Director of Regional Initiatives at the Bourse and Bazaar Foundation, a UK-based nonprofit think tank. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So Iranian officials have stepped up meetings and visits with their Arab neighbors over the past week or so. What is coming out of these conversations?
So it is interesting to note that the day after the Iranian missile attacks against Israel on October 1st, there was the meeting in Doha on the sidelines of the Asia Cooperation Dialogue. And it was the first time that there was an informal, albeit informal, joint ministerial meeting between the foreign ministers of the GCC states and Iran. At that meeting, the GCC states really wanted to convey reassurances to Iran, for example, that their airspaces will not be used by Israel or the U.S. for an attack against Iran. But at the same time, they also wanted to make sure that Iran understands and is on the same page with them with regards to attacks on their energy infrastructure. That is something that they are quite worried about, particularly when you look at what happened in 2019, 2020, when the Iranian-backed Houthis basically attacked Aramco facilities, oil facilities in Abqaiq and Khurais in Saudi Arabia, as well as off the coast of Fujairah in the UAE.
So all of these states, though, they have a good relationship with the U.S., and some like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have been normalizing ties with Israel, even as they oppose Israel's actions in Gaza and the West Bank. Where do they stand on an Israeli strike on Iran?
I think they are all six GCC states stand opposed to such a strike against Iran. Obviously, there are many considerations that the GCC states have against on Iran, particularly Iranian actions in the Middle East and its support for militants and non-state actors. And they have each state has a lot of bilateral issues with Iran, particularly the UAE with regards to the islands or Saudi Arabia on political issues in the region. But at the same time, they're not willing for the region to get dragged into a war. And they're really trying since October 7 last year to really try to prevent the war from expanding broader in the region.
And some of these Gulf Arab states or kingdoms host U.S. military bases, Bahrain, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. What does a war with Iran mean for them? Like, will those bases be targets?
So as you can see in the past few weeks, the statements coming out of the GCC states has been that they are basically trying to give messages to the US and to Iran officially and unofficially that their territory will not be used for an offensive attack against Iran. This is despite the fact that, for example, in the April missile attacks that Iran conducted against Israel, there are reports that Saudi Arabia and other Arab states were involved in intercepting Iranian missiles, for example, in cooperation with the U.S. and Israel. And this goes back to what has been going on between the U.S., Israel, and the GCC states for some time since the Trump administration in wanting to establish a Middle East air defense cooperation. And this basically falls in line to that. But the meetings of the past few days and few weeks, especially after the 1st of October attack, has been to basically tell Iran that the GCC states are conveying the messages to the U.S. that their military bases will not be used against that attack.
What do Washington and Tel Aviv get wrong about the relationship between Iran and its Arab neighbors?
I think in DC policy circles, you can see that in the past few years, there has been this push for normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia with the hopes that that will lead to a Palestinian state. But that has also been approached in a manner that it's an anti-Iran alliance. The GCC states that are party or partner to these agreements are not really viewing it in that same light. Obviously, the GCC states, as I mentioned, they have many anxieties and concerns with when it comes to Iran, but they do not really see a military alliance against Iran today would serve that purpose. Obviously, again, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE were part of the primary architects of the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. But the military attacks that occurred in 2019, 2020, and the lack of a U.S. response against Iran really pushed these countries to move forward and, towards dialogue and diplomacy rather than confrontation and isolation.
That's Mehran Haghirian of the Bourse and Bazaar Foundation. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Did you hear the one about how the government geoengineered Hurricane Helene just to get Kamala Harris elected? It's untrue. Or how the government is bulldozing the community of Chimney Rock, North Carolina, to get at its lithium deposits? This is also untrue. Or that the most you can expect to get from the Federal Emergency Management Agency is $750, no matter if your whole house was destroyed. This is not so. Those are just some of the outlandish falsehoods spreading on, where else, the internet in 2 weeks since Hurricane Helene hit. And there are some Hurricane Milton falsehoods going around as well. Congressman Chuck Edwards represents the hardest hit part of North Carolina and recently put out a press release to debunk these myths and falsehoods. He joins us now. Thank you, Congressman, for coming on. And I want to give my condolences to your constituents who have lost their loved ones because of Helene.
Well, thank you very much for that. Thanks for having me.
Do you feel like these sorts of rumors hurt the relief effort? And if so, how?
Well, first of all, they hurt the relief effort and the resources that it takes to debunk them. I had my staff in D.C. and here in the district answering phones, listening to constituents, and then responding when we could have been fielding the calls from folks that were still asking for help.
So who do you think is behind these rumors? And have you ever seen anything like this in your experience as a congressman after a disaster?
Well, this is my first natural disaster. This is my first term in Congress, and so it's my first natural disaster. So I don't have anything to compare it to. But there are folks out there all the time that start rumors. I really credit these rumors to old-fashioned storytelling. Most of us have been involved at one point in our life where we were told a story and then we were asked to pass it on to someone else, and someone else passed it on, and by four or five iterations, it looked considerably different than it did in the beginning. I'd like to credit some of these rumors to that type of innocent storytelling. But I also believe there are an awful lot of folks out there that like to increase their attention on social media, and sometimes they conjure things up just to get folks stirred up. There's no question some of that was taking place as well.
Well, former President Donald Trump has repeated some of these rumors, like the one about people only getting $750. He also said that Republican areas were specifically not getting the help that they needed because they were Republicans. You're a Republican. How do you feel about the leader of your party saying these sorts of things and giving your constituents misleading information like that?
Well, my focus is on trying to help the people here in Western North Carolina. And I know that sometimes folks that are running for office depend on people around them to inform them. Sometimes they're given incorrect information. I believe that may have been the case with the $750 rumor.
You don't have any evidence that the federal government is withholding aid to your area because it's predominantly Republican, right?
I don't believe that FEMA is making this political. I do believe, in fact, I'll tell you with great certainty that FEMA has been slow to respond. I don't believe that it's because it's political. I think that it's because it is a very complex and inefficient bureaucracy from the very top that has caused this problem. We just happen to be in a Republican district.
So I know you've suspended campaign events for your reelection so that you can focus on recovery efforts. What are you hearing and seeing on the ground from your constituents?
Folks are in either one of two categories. They have been unbelievably devastated by this storm and they're trying to pick up the pieces, or they're in the category of trying to help those folks who have been devastated. I'm just so heartened and so amazed at the effort that I see here in Western North Carolina to help folks. We've got church organizations, the Good Samaritans, emergency responders out collecting goods and distributing those to folks that still don't have power, that still need help. That's what I'm seeing here in Western North Carolina.
That's Congressman Chuck Edwards, Republican of North Carolina. Thank you so much for coming on.
All right. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the chance to chat with you.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Bagley Area Arts Collaborative, offering community exhibits, workshops, and many upcoming events. Announcing fall classes beginning in October, offering a colored pencil workshop on October 22nd, a Scandinavian snowflakes workshop on November 14th, and a needle felting workshop on December 7th. All are welcome to attend. More at BagleyArts.org or on Facebook. Go to KXE.org for the latest Up North report, local news from our region. Tune in during Morning Edition, World Cafe, and All Things Considered, or as a podcast. The Friends of the Hibbing Public Library and Mike's Pub invite you to Cheers to Books, a new book club on the second Monday of each month. There's a kickoff event Monday, October 14th at Mike's Pub to review books that will be read over the next 6 months. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Joyle Snyder with these headlines. The private space flight company SpaceX launched the fifth test flight of its enormous Starship today and returned the booster rocket to land for the first time. It was caught by giant mechanical arms at the same tower in South Texas where Starship blasted off. President Biden is visiting Florida's Gulf Coast today as damage left behind by Hurricanes Milton and Helene is still being assessed. Nearly 1 million customers remain without power in Florida. Milton is blamed for killing at least 10 people. In a Major League Baseball Baseball, the National League Championship Series between the Los Angeles Dodgers and the New York Mets starts later today. Game one is in Los Angeles. The American League Series begins tomorrow. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Last week, former President Donald Trump backed out of his interview with the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes. Vice President Kamala Harris went ahead with hers.
You want to expand the child tax credit.
Yes, I do.
You want to give tax breaks to first-time homebuyers.
Yes.
And people starting small businesses.
Correct.
And Harris spent the rest of the week on a media blitz. Here's some of what the presidential candidates said as they said it, with less than a month to go before Election Day.
And Congress has shown no inclination to move in your direction.
I disagree with you. There are plenty of leaders in Congress who understand and know that the Trump tax cuts blew up our federal deficit. None of us...
What do you think, too, of these judges basically saying whatever Trump does in office is okay?
This election is not 2016 or 2020, because that Supreme Court decision just a few months ago basically said to the former president, you will be immune from anything you do in office.
People who are in hospitals without their family, where the only touch that they had was of a nurse that they hadn't met because the family could not get there. And this man is giving COVID test kits to Vladimir Putin. Think about what this means on top of him sending love letters to Kim Jong-un. No, think about it. He thinks Vladimir Putin is his friend. What about the American people?
They're alleging that you have had several phone calls with Vladimir Putin over the last 3.5 years. Can I ask if that's true?
That's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. Look, I know Bob Woodward. You know, I'm suing him because he used tapes and he sold the tapes. He didn't just sell the book. He sold the tapes. He's not allowed to do it. He even says in the tape that he's not allowed to do it. And he sold the tapes. And I just think he's the bad guy, so I thought I'd have fun with it.
It's so simple. I mean, you know. This isn't like Elon with his rocket ships that land within 12 inches on the moon where they wanted to land. Or he gets the engines back. That was the first I realized. I said, who the hell did that? I saw engines about 3-4 years ago. These things were coming, cylinders, no wings, no nothing. And they're coming down very slowly, landing on a raft in the middle of the ocean someplace with a circle. Boom. Reminded me of the Biden circles that he used to have, right? He'd have 8 circles and he couldn't fill them up. But then I heard he beat us with the popular vote. I don't know. Couldn't fill up the 8 circles. I always loved those circles. They were so beautiful. They were so beautiful to look at. In fact, the person that did them, that was it.
Local election officials have lots to juggle this fall. There's the usual small changes to voting laws, training staff, producing ballots. But after 4 years of election conspiracies and outright denial, officials are now tasked with something else: combating rampant misinformation and protecting staff from threats, sometimes physical. One of those election officials is Justin Roebuck. He's the Republican county clerk in Ottawa County, Michigan, where he oversees elections, and he joins us now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So you've helped to run elections for almost two decades, and I'm sure there's always some pressure this time of the year before a major election, but how does this election compare to past ones?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, any presidential election is a very major event. But I think what's significantly different for us in this cycle has been just sort of a ramp up of efforts at misinformation, groups that have maybe spawned earlier in the cycle of 2016 and 2020 have certainly taken hold and taken root more. And so we're dealing certainly with those challenges as well.
So much of this distrust goes back to 2020 when Donald Trump falsely said he won the election. Did that denialism take hold in Ottawa County?
I mean, yeah, I think, you know, we're roughly 70% Republican community in Ottawa County. So, you know, in the 2020 election cycle, Donald Trump received 67% of the vote. You know, we were subject to a couple of filings in court cases in Michigan in December of 2020. Affidavits were filed in federal court alleging that we had turnout in excess of 100% in certain precincts of our community, which were totally false, unfortunately. I mean, they were completely false allegations. And so really, from the very first days following the 2020 election, we have been combating outright lies about our community. But beyond that, I think, you know, we are dealing with the day-to-day questions that people may have who are not as keyed into the process. They just have generally questions about, you know, how can I trust that this system works well? How can I trust that our votes are being counted correctly and that there's only one vote per person? And, you know, those are questions that we really care a lot about answering and being transparent about and being honest about.
Do people believe the answers that you give?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. When we look at our community, and I think this is a lot of anecdotal evidence that I have, but we've got 10% of folks who really love us and think we can do no wrong. And that's very nice sometimes to hear that. But we also have 10% of people on the other end of the spectrum, I think, we're probably never going to be able to convince them. And really, our main focus is on that 80%. Our main focus is to try to drive good fact-based communication to the 80% of our community that just wants to know.
Well, 4 years later, how are you getting that information to them?
Yeah, I think predominantly for us, it comes through transparent behavior. And so we're really focused on being as transparent as possible. And there are a lot of ways in the, you know, that we're required by law to be transparent. But we're trying to go the extra mile and make sure that we're doing community events and that we're hosting, you know, town hall forums. So I think it's about availability. It's about transparency. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, we are a drop in the ocean in terms of the megaphone that others have. And unfortunately, others who are spreading misinformation, whether that's media organizations or personalities or political candidates. And I think for us, the important thing is to be that reliable source of information for our community.
I have to ask you, you face threats and lawsuits and you've had to push back on even members of your own party. What is it that keeps you in this line of work?
One is that I fundamentally believe that trust matters so deeply. You know, our democratic process is built upon trust. That's the currency that we operate in as election officials. But then, you know, the other reason that I do it and I'm passionate about doing it is for my kids. You know, I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old, and they deserve to grow up and live in a place where we can trust our democracy, right? Where we can continue. I want them to register to vote as 18-year-olds and believe in this process and have a safe and secure method of casting their ballots for their future.
That's Justin Roebuck. He is the county clerk in Ottawa County, Michigan. Clerk Roebuck, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
When you think of German food, you probably think of stereotypes like potatoes, cabbage, and sausages. And maybe maybe schnitzel.
A crowd pleaser, who doesn't love a delicious schnitzel?
But we bet you've never heard of quark. No, not the subatomic particle, the dairy product.
Germans eat it for breakfast, they eat it for lunch, they eat it for dinner, they bake with it. So yeah, it's funny, that's one of those ingredients that is just so, so German, and there's so little known about it.
Are you intrigued? Well, learn the mystery of quark and everything else you didn't know about classic German cooking. Hear it later today on All Things Considered by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. It should be easier to get methadone today than it has been in decades. In April, the federal government loosened some of the rules around obtaining the addiction medication. But as New England Public Media's Karen Brown reports, many patients are still not benefiting from these new changes.
Kellyanne Kaiser says she abused opioids from the age of 13 into her late 20s. She tried a lot of different addiction treatments.
I think just methadone is just what got me sober. Without that, I would still be using.
But it hasn't always been easy to get the sticky pink liquid that relieves her opioid cravings and withdrawal symptoms. At first, she had to drive an hour from her Western Massachusetts home to a methadone clinic.
And I have three little children, so I would have to find a babysitter for them, go out there and come back. I used to have to go to every single day.
Now there's a clinic closer to her home, and Kaiser only has to go once a month. That's because new federal rules allow her to take methadone bottles home. Dr. Ruth Potee oversees her treatment at the nonprofit Behavioral Health Network.
The old rules, you had to be in clinic for 90 days, and you had to never miss a day to get one bottle. So that's a lot of perfection.
Methadone, which locks up opiate receptors in the brain, was first introduced to treat addiction in the 1960s. With its high street value and potential for abuse, the federal government set up strict rules around how to get it, including daily visits to a high-security methadone clinic and mandatory counseling.
And they never went back to change it, despite decades of increasing addiction.
Under the new rules, patients still have to get methadone at clinics, but if they meet the criteria, they can take weeks' worth of bottles home, and providers have more leeway in dosing. Ingvild Olsen directs substance abuse treatment for the federal government. She says regulators first tried out the new rules as a COVID measure, and as she put it, the sky didn't fall.
This did not increase the rate of methadone-related mortality, for example, which had been one of the concerns.
And her agency put in guardrails to limit abuse and black market sales. Kellyanne Kaiser says she had to earn the right to take methadone at home.
I had to pass so many drug tests to get it, and then you have to take a class in order, like a safety class on what you do with your methadone, how you keep it safe in your home.
Kaiser lost custody of her son when she was using illegal opioids, and she credits methadone with getting him back. But Kaiser lives in Massachusetts, a state that embraced the new flexibility around methadone treatment. Not all places have. The federal standards are voluntary. Olson says states can choose to keep their rules more strict, including daily check-ins.
There are some states that are still really looking at and figuring out what's going to work best for their states.
She says her staff is encouraging states to fully implement the federal guidelines. But many advocates say adoption has been frustratingly slow.
Substance use treatment programs love rules.
Brian Hurley heads the American Society for Addiction Medicine. He says clinic culture is mired in the way things have always been done. So he's trying to help local methadone clinics set up new protocols.
Shifting the approach from a rules-based to a patient-centered approach.
But there are reasons providers are going slowly. Mark Perino is head of the American Association for the Treatment of Opioid Dependence, a trade group for methadone clinics.
Methadone is a very therapeutic medication when it's used wisely. But if it's used unwisely, it's unforgiving.
Patients can overdose on methadone. And while Perino says his group approves of the new flexibility, they worry about liability when patients are not closely supervised. And there's a financial piece. Perino says clinics, many of them for-profit, are waiting to see if Medicaid changes how it pays for methadone treatment when patients come in less frequently. Otherwise,
the programs absolutely lose money. Some would not be able to continue.
But even if the federal rules are put into wide practice, many addiction doctors say they don't go far enough to break the clinic's monopoly on methadone. They support proposed legislation that would allow methadone to be prescribed by any board-certified addiction doctor and picked up at a regular pharmacy. The Clinic Trade Association opposes the measure. For NPR News, I'm Karen Brown.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. At the bottom of a deep red canyon in southern Utah, the Colorado River is restoring itself, or at least a part of itself, even as climate change shrinks its volume. And that has river enthusiasts celebrating. Long forgotten whitewater rapids are reemerging upstream. Reporter Luke Runyon set out to find out more.
Oh, we just docked our boats to scout Gypsum Canyon Rapid. The sky is blue, the sun is out, it's hot, and you can hear the water roaring.
I walk down this main wave train and look for this domer rock and tuck underneath that.
Professional river guide Pete LaFave has been down Cataract Canyon more than 130 times, but he's never seen Gypsum Rapid. And it looks mean, a churning, roiling mess of water and boulders.
It's steep, it's sharp, it's must make move, and yeah, I'm nervous.
LaFave has never seen this rapid because for more than 50 years, it's been buried under mud. Cataract Canyon is a transition zone where the dammed up waters of Lake Powell start backing up and sediment buries whatever's on the bottom. But since 2000, Lake Powell has dropped 100 feet. So here, the river is starting to behave like a river again, carving down and excavating these long buried boulders. Mike Dehoff is another experienced river runner.
Cataract Canyon, I think these days, is like a friend that was in a car accident or had a terrible sickness that has come home from the hospital.
In 2019, he and Pete LaFave started the Returning Rapids Project. Dehoff's wife, Meg Flynn, a librarian in nearby Moab, keeps its archive. Using old photos from before Lake Powell's dam was built, they anticipate when and where new rapids might again show themselves.
We see here how flowing water brings life. And that the river, if you give it a chance, can recover at a rate that is really astounding to all of us.
The group has now seen at least seven formerly buried rapids reemerge, with names like the Chute, LaRue's Riffle, and Can Opener. In addition to the ones that never disappeared, like Little Niagara or Satan's Gut. Jack Schmidt runs Utah State University's Center for Colorado River Studies.
As a geologist, We study rates of change that are invariably slow. I mean, my heavens, things are just going gangbusters here.
Schmidt says the Colorado River's problems are significant. The region struggles with a massive gap between water supply and demand. These changes are only happening because the giant reservoir has dropped precipitously under warming temperatures.
You know, at the same time, this place is both a reservoir in crisis and a river restoring itself. It's both those things.
Back in our yellow inflatable rafts, Pete LaFave dips his oars into the water just above Gypsum Canyon Rapid.
Well, here we go.
The boat drops into the newly returned whitewater, its nose pointed right into massive cresting waves. After making it through that brand new rapid, LaFave says he can't wait to see which one comes back next. For NPR News, I'm Luke Runyon in Cataract Canyon, Utah.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Dragonfly Coffee, located in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more, empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special order pricing and more at drinkdragonfly.com. The set list is our weekly primer on live music, curated by KAXE's music team. The set list spotlights shows at area venues. KAXE.org, click live music under local events. Celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day in Grand Rapids tomorrow from 1 to 5 on the Central School lawn and at the Ginnowin Creative Space. There will be a drum group, artist vendors, art activities, and more. And tune in Thursday mornings at 6:20 for fishing advice with guide Jeff Sundin. Have a question? Text 218-326-1234.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Israeli forces are now 9 days into a major military operation in northern Gaza. Israel is also battling Hezbollah militants in southern Lebanon as the region remains on high alert for a potential Israeli response to Iran's missile attacks 2 weeks ago. Iran has threatened severe consequences if it's attacked. New Zealand has taken a 3-0 lead over Britain in sailing's America's Cup competition. The first team to 7 victories wins the Cup. New Zealand is trying to win it for a third straight time. And Spanish scientists say explorer Christopher Columbus was likely a Sephardic Jew from Western Europe. The researchers conducted a 22-year investigation using DNA analysis to arrive at their conclusion. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Insperity, providing HR services and technology from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. There's a chill in the air. Candy corn at the store. You know what that means. It's officially spooky season. Now, some of us like to celebrate this time of year by curling up in front of a good old-fashioned scary movie. I know I do. NPR's Glenn Weldon and I have that in common. He's one of the hosts of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Good to have you on, Glenn.
Great to be here.
Okay, so I hear that you're not just a fan of horror movies, although that is more than enough for me. You like a particular type of horror, folk horror. Now, what makes folk horror different from any other scary movie?
Well, first of all, it's a genre that's made right now for this time of year. You know, the days are getting shorter, the nights are getting darker, the leaves are turning. This genre of horror has a very pagan harvest festival, autumn solstice vibe. So grab some hot cider and settle in. Folk horror is often set in remote, isolated areas where nature still holds sway. Well, not just nature. Nature combined with local superstitions.
Superstitions that can be scary. Yeah. Now, okay. So the movie that I think jumps to mind for many people would be that 2019 movie Midsummer with Florence Pugh, where she goes to Sweden for the Midsummer Festival and things take a seriously dark turn. Is that what we're talking about here?
That's exactly the vibe. The folk horror genre is getting kind of a resurgence right now, and that's a perfect modern-day example, which is set all in and around a fertility festival.
I invited my friends because this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and I wanted to share it, especially with my friends who I knew would appreciate it, because I, I am proud of this place.
Okay, but I'm not an anthropologist and I don't understand any of this.
Yes, I know, I know. And yet I was the most excited for you to come.
Oh, don't trust that guy. The classic example is 1973's The Wicker Man, in which a very uptight British policeman visits this remote Scottish island to investigate the disappearance of a young girl. Turns out the locals have embraced a form of Celtic paganism, and that does not sit right with him.
You suspect foul play?
I suspect murder.
We don't commit murder up here. We're a deeply religious people.
Yeah, things don't end well for that guy. Shocking to learn. So The Wicker Man was the first folk horror film that I saw as a kid, which is maybe why I still love folk horror that's set in 1970s Britain. Just the fashions, Aisha, the mustaches, yes. The tight bell bottoms. I call that era the talismans and turtlenecks era of horror, because it occurred at a time when interest in the occult became kind of a fad that inspired a wave of folk horror films, specifically inflected with a kind of satanic panic. The Dunwich Horror is a great example of that, a very cheesy example of that. You can tell the bad guy in that movie, Aisha, because he's got not one, but two pinky rings, one on each hand.
Oh, my God. The pinky rings, you got to watch out for that. That's a bad sign. That's you're working
in
with
real
Satan
life and in
right
film.
There. no offense to the pinky ring wearers out there. So with folk horror, are we talking about the supernatural or is it all the kind of the weird people who are the folks, you know what I'm saying?
In these That's stories. Exactly. The thing I love best about it is you can never tell with any given film, because some folk horror involves the supernatural, but I kind of like the ones that don't, right? That where the stories are, you know, it's about the folk themselves, the locals and their beliefs that are the true source of horror. So do check out The Wicker Man, but you want to be careful here. You want to check out the 1973 version. There is a remake with Nicolas Cage. You're going to want to skip that one.
What is that? Oh, no, not the beast! Not the beast! Ah! I love my eyes!
I like that one. That's the only one I've seen. So I need to see the original one.
You're killing me. Just do me a favor. See the OG. See the 1973. And then get back to me. The Witchfinder General has a great Vincent Price performance. More recent examples are films like Kill List, Men, The Ritual, Apostle, The Medium. New film came out this year called Starve Acre. I'm throwing out a lot of names, but if you want to dip your toe into this genre, a really great place to start is a documentary called Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched, A History of Folk Horror, that you can find streaming on a lot of different platforms right now.
Okay, I love The Ritual. I saw that. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. That's a good one. I haven't seen the rest of them, but I will start looking into them.
Now's the time.
Yes. So there are lots of types of horror. You know, I talked to the director of the new movie, The Substance, recently. That was body horror.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, very body horror. Uh-huh. And sometimes horror movies, you know, they can definitely be funny.
Yep.
When it comes to folk horror, what should we make of these movies that seem to be about outsiders, interlopers who get into trouble, and nature?
Yeah, well, let me get a little grad school on you, because folk horror, if you think about it, is rooted in very old superstitions about everything that lies beyond the edges of society, right? Spirits of the woods, spirits of the field. It's a kind of rejection of industrialization, of this whole notion that humanity can ever conquer the earth, right? That there's something out there in the dark waiting for us, and it's generally tied to a specific place. Mm-hmm. So think of it as hyper-local horror, right? Farm-to-table horror. That's the cultural component. But psychologically, it's also playing on, I think, pretty universal feelings of alienation and isolation that we all have that make us all feel like outsiders, sometimes in our own communities. It gives those feelings solid flesh. And when the supernatural is involved, sometimes that flesh kind of pulses and oozes. Sometimes it's furry and sometimes it's clawed. Mm-hmm. But whenever the story is about the way it's just us humans clinging to beliefs in the supernatural, the flesh involved is very, very human, and by the time the movie's over, it's probably going to get stabbed with a sacrificial dagger or two.
Yes, and that's always, you know, the best part, when they bring out the sacrificial dagger.
They're always very pretty, bejeweled.
That's Glenn Weldon, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Thank you so much, Glenn.
Happy spooky season.
Now, what if you like horror movies to come with animals? There's always been plenty of options, from classics like Jaws.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
And the newer cult classic like Cocaine Bear.
A bear did cocaine!
But how do you feel about The Day of the Raccoons? Okay, it's not an actual movie, but it sounds like one. A woman in Kitsap County, Washington, regularly fed raccoons on her property without any problems. Until a few weeks ago, when suddenly the few raccoons she was feeding ballooned to around 100. The Kitsap County Sheriff's Office says those raccoons showed up demanding and hungry, scratching at her house at all hours, surrounding her in her car when she tried to drive. That's right. The woman was so spooked, she called 911.
I'm right in my car. They chased me all the way out through the backyard. They're falling all over.
You're not able to get out of your car. You're stuck in your vehicle.
I had to get in my vehicle to get away from them. They're all around my car.
It's still unclear why the number of raccoons exploded. Maybe word got out about the free snacks. Anyway, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife says the woman had not technically broken any state laws. She has since stopped feeding raccoons and they have gone away. But obviously, the department recommends people don't feed wild animals because you could end up making your own horror movie. Mabel the mouse lives in a little cabin on a lake.
The Ship in the Window it's a story about a mouse that kind of risks it all for a chance at adventure.
In librarian Travis Yonker's latest children's book, Mabel lives with a boy and his father, who spent months meticulously building a model ship.
At nighttime, Mabel will come out and she'll look at the ship and she'll wonder if it can sail like a real ship. You know, she's the perfect size to be the captain, and she would love to try that sometime. It's the man's prized possession. He never lets anybody touch it. He doesn't let his son touch it. Until one night, the door is left open just a little bit, and Mabel realizes she can either try to get the ship outside and onto the lake, or she can stay in the safe cabin. And you can probably guess what choice she makes. But it doesn't quite turn out how she planned.
The Ship in the Window is illustrated by Caldecott medalist Matthew Cordell, and he and Travis Yonker share the story of the real model ship behind The Ship in the Window for our series of conversations between authors and illustrators. Picture this.
When my kids were little, especially, we would visit this park that's nearby in Holland, Michigan. And right across from the park, there's a house that has this beautiful model ship in the window. And so I thought, oh, I've seen this model ship so many times. What's a story that could go along with it?
Travis posted a picture yesterday on Instagram of him sitting in front of this house with a copy of our book. He says he does not know them.
I've visited a few different times now, and no one's ever home. I have my copy already inscribed. Thanks for the inspiration. I can't wait to give them a copy of the book, talk to them about it. I want to ask them about the model ship.
It's a huge ship, too. I mean, is it big? Like, it looks big in the photograph.
Yeah, it's probably, I don't know, 3 feet tall or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so the ship that I drew is not as big as that one, because if I drew the ship too big, the mouse would be like really tiny. So I had to consider that too, but I knew nothing about sailing and ships or anything. So I did some research and I found a ship called an H.M. Cutter Mermaid from 1817. I found a guy building the ship on YouTube and I took a bunch of screenshots of this guy. Thanks, whoever you are.
One of the inspirations, too, for me for this story was picture books from the past that I really love. We both really love William Steig's work. The book that really stuck out to me when thinking about The Ship in the Window was Amos and Boris. That's another, you know, mouse main character story, and it's on the high seas. And so I really had that in mind as I was working on this story, and I think Matthew's illustrations just completely nailed it.
After reading Travis's story, it felt like it could really benefit from this sort of heavily cross-hatched old world drawing approach. So they look almost sort of vintage, the drawings. A lot of line work, cross-hatched line drawings, and also sort of a limited palette, very few colors, so it feels like it could have been printed in a different earlier time. So the book has this sort of old school look to it, and it reads the same way, I think.
I don't think I set out to be like, I want this to be sort of a vintage, timeless picture book, but I feel like once you start writing the story, sometimes that comes out of it, and then you sort of go with that feeling, you know?
I have to say, too, one of my favorite videos, Matthew made some great ones while he was working on the book. There's a couple spreads where the amount of crosshatching that he does is like astounding. And so he made one video where he's doing all these thousands, millions of little marks. And then at the end, he just passes out from exhaustion because of all the crosshatching that he had to do. It makes the illustrations so rich, so beautiful.
The ones that take the longest, there were a few that had night sky. So I was basically filling in a massive portion of the drawing in crossed lines. It would take me like a couple days sometimes. My brain would get a little screwy at times. But for the most part, it's kind of a nice, relaxing way to make a picture.
Yeah, I love the spread where Mabel notices that the door is open just a crack. I love it because you show like the representation of like the breeze blowing in, the curling breeze blowing in the door. And Mabel's like noticing that and she's wondering if she's going to give it a shot or not.
There's something really nice about mice. They're sort of the most humble of creatures. They're very small. They feel very harmless and vulnerable. I think it was a wise choice to choose a mouse as the character that brought together these more imposing sized mammals in the house.
One thing too that I was thinking about after the fact is the idea of like how many people have things in their life where they're saving it or they're not touching it or they don't want someone else to use it. You know, I think as like a parent all the time, there's like things that you're trying to keep safe from your kids. And honestly, the person that changes the most in the story is the man.
Yeah, the man is kind of not nice, seems like. You know, I wanted to draw him in that way where it felt like he was unapproachable and he wears these glasses. In fact, I don't think you ever see his eyes. You only see the reflection of the glasses, which makes him even a little more imposing.
He kind of goes from having this attitude of, this ship is my prized possession. I don't let anybody touch this thing. I don't let anybody help me to make it. To at the very end of the story, inviting the boy and even inviting Mabel in to kind of work together on it. And I guess I just like the idea of, hey, maybe if you actually just kind of like loosen up a little bit, it can open the door for this connection that wasn't there before.
That's one of the things I really liked about the story is how there's these three separate characters living their own existence. And by the end of it, they see the value of togetherness and not just working independently or creating independently or fantasizing and dreaming independently. And that's a really beautiful thing about the book, I think.
That was illustrator Matthew Cordell and author Travis Yonker talking about their new kid's book. And hey, if you are Travis Yonker's neighbor in Michigan and you have a model ship in your window, answer your door. He just wants to give you a copy of The Ship in the Window. For more conversations between authors and illustrators, you can head to npr.org/picturethis. Our series is produced by Samantha Balaban.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. To find out more about the books and authors you hear on NPR's programs, go to npr.org/books. There you'll find author interviews, NPR's bestseller lists, and find out what our staff is reading.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Check out playlist podcasts and more at KAXE.org. We receive support from Bemidji Symphony Orchestra, a community orchestra servicing North Central Minnesota, bringing classical music to audiences and providing performance experience for musicians. More at BemidjiSymphony.org. Verse Like Water, the visiting poet program at Central Lakes College in Brainerd, presents Indigenous